and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Imagine waking up one morning and walking outside your house and seeing U.S. military, U.S. Marines lining your street on every street corner. New instructions for everybody. Times had changed overnight. Could it happen? Well, Harry Helms obviously thinks so, and I know a lot of you do too, and I'd like to give you an opportunity to talk about it. So you get with your phones, and I'll get you with Harry. In safe America, right? Could you wake up, say, 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning, one morning, to the sound of gunfire outside your house and hear the military en masse beginning to take things over? Harry, could such a nightmare scenario really happen?
Yes, indeed. As I note in my book, in the 90s, the U.S. military began conducting numerous exercises in major American cities, such as Miami, Chicago, Houston, where it was the injection of troops to take command and control of certain areas. There has been, since the 1960 urban riots, a plan called Operation Garden Plot, which is for calls for the use of U.S. military forces in urban areas. This has been revised numerous times since the mid-1960s, is still operational. And as I point out in my book, surveys of troops, a group of U.S. Marines done by a professor with the U.S. War College, show that over a quarter of active duty troops indicated they would be willing to fire upon U.S. civilians, unarmed civilians, if so ordered by their superiors.
Boy, that's a sobering statistic. That was what percentage again, please?
The exact percentage would be that 26.34% would be willing to fire upon civilians if so ordered by their superiors. And this was done in 1994 study by Lieutenant Commander Ernest Cunningham for a master's degree he was working on at the Naval Postgraduate
School. I remember the big controversy about all of that. But here I go. I'm going to play devil's advocate again. If 20-some-odd percent would shoot fellow Americans, that means 70-some-odd percent wouldn't.
That's the comforting thing.
And,
comforting.
Yes, and so wouldn't that, on the face of it, just even based on those outrageous numbers, wouldn't that prevent what we're talking about right now from occurring, because not enough would, in fact, enough might fight back, in that given situation to prevent even the thought of someone implementing something like that.
But we might be in a situation then where that you could perhaps compose special units from those 26% who answered in the affirmative for these sorts of operations.
I hadn't thought of that. All right, I'd like to begin to put together some phone calls here. Let's see how we do. My phones are acting strange tonight, but let's try. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Harry Helms. Hello?
Hello, this is William. I'm currently going up a mountain pass in Colorado in the snow.
On the way up the a mountain pass in Colorado in the snow, all right?
Yeah, well, anyway, a couple statements I wanted to make and then mention a book to you. What you were talking about the internment camp, Bill Cooper wrote a book that had some of that stuff in it. He'd contacted the military police in Livonia, Michigan, and they would not deny it, but they said at least you called the right place.
Do you know anything about that, Harry?
I have heard of rumors of those types of camps in Michigan that he's referring to. Yes, indeed.
Okay.
Well, they're just the military police in charge of it. But a federal lawsuit was brought in the Houston federal court, and it was dismissed because they were saying it violated people's civil rights to set up internment camps, and the judge wouldn't hear the case because he said as long as everyone is treated the same, it doesn't violate your civil rights. But anyway, There's a book by Bill Cooper called The Hold a Pale Horse, which covers a lot of this information, has a lot of documents in it. And if you haven't seen it, you might be interested in it.
I'm very, very well aware of it. Thank you. I'm always, I mean, this is such an incredibly sensitive subject. The fact, I'll tell you, Harry, I'm a little bit comforted by the fact that I can go on the air and talk about it still, about what you and I are talking about right now, without getting shut down. Don't you find that sort of comforting?
I find it comforting, but then on the other hand, President Roosevelt's Executive Order 9066, which he used in 1942 to order the detention of Japanese Americans without warrants or charges for as long as he deemed fit, that warrant was that executive order was twice challenged before the U.S. Supreme Court.
And held.
Both times it was upheld. So a future president could insert, instead of Japanese Americans, could have black Americans, Hispanic Americans, Americans who voted for the other candidate in the last election, and do the same thing. And it's already been pre-approved by the U.S. Supreme Court.
Huh. Okay. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Harry Helms. Hello.
Hello, this is a friend.
Hey, friend.
Hi.
Hi, friend.
I want to comment something towards Harry.
Proceed.
Something that's non-apparent and effective in the future could prevent future violence within the United States.
Yes?
I just like that idea of a non-apparent security system by the military.
A non-apparent security system by the military. Isn't that what we've got, Harry? A non-apparent...
I'm trying to figure how it could provide security without being apparent.
Yeah.
Well, that means that it's within a controlled medium that is... How can I say? It's like a control, monitoring, synchronicity, and coordination station that is like an I.O., as you're a radio person, to check certain security features to make sure that there's no outbreak of disorder.
Huh.
Simple as that.
Simple as that, huh? Harry, is it as simple as that?
I somewhat doubt it'd be quite that simple. I don't see how you could have a security system that would be non-apparent.
Non-apparent, right.
You would have to recognize that you are subject to a certain sanction if you did something in order to have a security system. Seems almost by definition.
It seems like, yeah. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Harry Helms. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Hello.
Yes,
you're going to have to yell at us, sir. You're not too loud.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, I wanted to make a comment to Harry. I believe that's your guest.
Yes.
Yes, on the out-of-control government, okay. Our founding fathers set up this government to serve the people and not for the people to serve the government.
Yes.
As the government, or as the people is the government. Okay, and I'll take a classic example of that. I don't know if you've ever been to Waco, Texas.
Waco, Texas. Yes, I've been to Waco, yes.
Yeah, back in 1993. Those people did nothing to anybody. But the federal government came down here, because I'm just outside of Dallas, Texas.
Yep.
And burned women, children, men too, over nothing.
All right. Well, I don't know. Harry, I actually went through the whole Waco affair on the air, dealt with it on the air for a very long time. Looking back on Waco, Harry, how do you see it?
That is an early example of, in my book, what I termed the militarization of civilian law enforcement, where you had military advisors to the FBI, and the use of military equipment, like an armored personnel carrier, against civilians. And that was perhaps the first public demonstration of how the line between civilian law enforcement and militarized law enforcement is becoming increasingly blurred.
Certainly, I think most people would regard it as not a really proud moment for America.
Well, it's an example of what can happen when certain powers are used without good judgment and proper discretion, where the situation, I think, got rapidly out of the FBI's hand and led to a very rapid escalation of force on their side without sufficient provocation from the other side.
Good enough. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Harry Helms. Hello.
Hey, good morning, Art.
Good morning.
And good morning to you, Harry.
Good morning.
Harry, I'd prefer not to give my call letters or my...
Well, please don't. That's all right. Don't give us anything. Just go ahead.
I'm in Army Mars.
Yeah.
And my license on the wall is signed by the Secretary of Defense, DOD and Secretary of the Army. But I'm not military. I'm not paid. And I have to use my own equipment. What you guys are talking about this morning kind of puts me in a rather difficult position. I have to serve Mars the best I can, but if the government turns against me, I have to revert back to my oath that I took when I joined the Marine Corps to defend this country against all...
All right, caller, I've got a question for you. Operating your Mars station, if you became aware of a situation, an emergency that had been declared in the United States by, say, the President of the United States, and you heard or were even part of handling traffic that indicated to you that the U.S. government was, in fact, moving en masse against its own citizens in an obviously unconstitutional way, would you follow orders? Would you pass that traffic? Or would you throw up your hands and say, it's time for a change?
Well, that's rather interesting.
Yes, and that's why I asked it.
In a kind of a dilemma, too. I want to be a good citizen, but no, I don't think I would. I think I'd refuse the traffic or at least make some sort of an excuse about my equipment went down on me or something.
All right, so there you go, Harry. That's exactly, I guess, again, the kind of thing that I was talking about a few moments ago when you gave me the percentage, horrid and horrific as it is, of the military that would fire on civilians if they were ordered to do so. There's an example of a guy who's in a, you know, at least a fairly important position, who would not pass such traffic, who would make a decision on his own, making such a nightmare impossible.
And I salute the caller for that decision, but the danger lies in that the percentage of those who would take part in this may be small, but if they have access to sufficient firepower or other means of controlling or managing a population, even that small number could be devastatingly effective.
Okay. International Line, you're on the air with Harry Helms, and I'm Art Bell. Hello.
Is that me?
That's you.
Oh, okay. Yes, I'm Carol in Aberdeen.
Hello, Carol.
KXRO.
Yes.
Well, first off, FEMA's already been practicing down in Texas when they jumped over those old people in their homes here a while back. But FEMA can declare for the sake of...
I'm sorry, I think we missed the last part of what you were saying. If FEMA can do what?
FEMA can declare martial law in the case of diseases, you know, like we're having an outbreak of all these different so-called diseases.
Here's a good point, yes?
And then I'm seeing where the, you know, HARP is affecting the behavior from last night's show. We have a humongous amount of people that are being put in prisons, like our drug companies are just overloading us with depression pills that literally drove my daughter almost to the point of suicide, those pills.
Okay.
I had to get her off of them. And we've got millions of people in prisons. And they're all
first-time callers, area code 775-727-1222.
Stop. Don't be naming people for
us.
Okay. So the thrust of your question was what?
And what other countries own our prisons?
What? Oh, really? You know, there has been certainly a movement in America to privatize the prison system, to actually put it in the hands of companies that would run prisons. Anything on that, Harry?
I would just correct one misconception that your caller did make, and this is a common misconception. FEMA by itself cannot declare martial law. FEMA is simply the president's toolkit, if you will, when he declares a national emergency or martial law. FEMA is the muscle, but it's not the actual instigator in and of itself. It takes orders from the president or some other competent authority to perform certain tasks. As far as the thing with private prisons, I have to be very honest with you and say I have no real knowledge of that area.
All right. She asked about prisoners being housed outside the United States. That's not going on, is it?
Not to the best of my knowledge, nor do I believe that there are any standby plans for housing Americans outside the United States.
At least with regard to American citizens. Certainly, Al-Qaeda,
yes.
We've taken who knows where. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Harry Helms. Hello.
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 Yes, hello.
Oh, I'm sorry, hi.
Yes, that's you.
Oh, cool. Hi, Art. Hi, Harry. I got a question. After, Executive Order Memo 66, when President Roosevelt interned more than 120,000 Americans of Japanese ancestry, and then in August 10th, 1988, Ronald Reagan, President Reagan, signed H.R. 442, which gave the apologies and the compensation to more than 70,000 Japanese Americans. Isn't that like a justification or like an identification to say that what we did to the Japanese American was wrong? They paid them back, even though it was only $20,000.
Okay.
It could be construed as such, but the fact of the matter is that did not repeal Executive Order 9066, nor did it impact negatively its legality. Executive Order 9066 was twice upheld by the United States Supreme Court. It is still there for a future president to use as he sees fit against any group of people he sees fit. I think you should understand that in terms of maybe domestic political considerations rather than having any bearing upon its legality or its potential for misuse in the future.
So we didn't, other than making a payment, which was like an admission of wrong, other than that, and a big I'm sorry, we didn't change the thing that would allow that exact same thing to occur again.
There was no change to the order itself or its legal standing whatsoever. It was simply a public relations exercise, nothing more.
Could that be, says the devil, because there has to be something that radical in place, something so radical that after you do it, you have to apologize for it in order to fight the dangers that we face.
I always find it interesting that that whenever we talk in terms of national security dangers, it seems almost as if the Bill of Rights is the greatest threat to Americans rather than, say, foreign terrorists or foreign military powers. Now, that does not affect, let's say, the operational capabilities of, say, of Al-Qaeda or, say, of China. It does, however, go right to the heart of the freedoms and rights that make us a unique nation.
Well, it sure is hard to be legal and constitutional when the other side can do any damn thing they want. But I understand what you're saying, Harry.
It's been a too long time
since I've played this or thought about the words.
No peace of mind. And I'm ready for the times to get better.
Better would be good. This is Coast to Coast AM, cruising through the nighttime with Harry Helms. I'm Art Bell. Good morning.
From coast to coast and worldwide on the internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Just the very fact that we can get on talk radio nationwide, as we're doing right now, and talk about a subject as sensitive as this, to me, is almost like a beacon in the night saying, it's still okay, it's still okay. But then there's another beacon in the night going, but you better keep your eyes open, better keep your eyes open. And that's what this is all about. Harry Helms has written a book that has prompted this discussion tonight, entitled Inside the Shadow Government. Inside the Shadow Government. The title of your book, right, Harry?
That's correct, Art.
Let's see, a million questions. How is your book doing?
I understand it's doing rather well. It's available through most major outlets, bookstores, including Amazon.com and your website.
All right. And if you read this book, you really do take people inside what you believe to be the real shadow government.
Because of the nature of the subject matter, I thought it was very important that I provide as much documentation as possible. So in there you'll see extracts from various federal laws that give President the power, for example, to seize control of radio and TV stations,
mm-hmm.
or to declare martial law. And I reproduced the full text of several presidential executive orders, including Order 9066, the one President Roosevelt used to detain
right.
Japanese Americans for the duration of World War II.
Did you worry at all during the time you were penning this book that you might not be allowed to publish it?
No, but there was certainly a total lack of cooperation when I, for example, filed various Freedom of Information Act requests. Either I had to repeat my request to get the documents, or when I got them, they were largely blacked out. So there was no official encouragement, but they were certainly passive-aggressive in their approach to dealing with me.
Nobody came to you and said, publish and die?
Not yet.
Okay. All right. Just checking. International Line, you're on the air with Harry Helms. Hello. Hello?
Hello.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is Morris the Cat from Delray Beach, Florida.
There's no person named Morris the Cat.
Yeah, I'm on WJNO West Palm.
Whatever you're on, you can't be truly named Morris the Cat.
Well, I'm named after the cat on television, but I'm not as finicky. I'll eat anything you serve.
All right, Morris.
Yeah, this is in reference to the FTAA beating. I'm a 75-year-old disabled American veteran, and I was at the FTAA rally in Miami Beach a few weeks ago,
uh-huh.
and there I saw an amphibious tank with a 30-caliber machine gun manned, and also an amphibious personnel carrier up on the little hill there, and, of course, a couple of thousand full-body armored, I call them thugs, and these was sent by our illustrious Governor Jeb Bush
mm-hmm.
Against a peaceable rally against the FTAA so that our children and grandchildren's jobs wouldn't be exported. Now, where does this come into the shadow government?
All right, it's a good question. Not just there, but what about Seattle? There's a very large movement out there against these various meetings which are designed to promote trade and, in the view of many, in fact, eliminate American jobs in the process. The protests have been large, the response at times violent on both sides. Where does all this fit in, Harry?
It's an example of the increased militarization of civilian law enforcement that we discussed in the last hour. And some of the things that your caller is now discussing, I think, is covered by a document called Army Field Manual 19-15, dated November 1985, and is titled Civil Disturbances. And that outlines the tactics and procedures and methodologies that would be used by the United States Army if called upon to assist in the suppression of a civil disturbance or to be on standby in case of a civil disturbance of some sort. That document outlines how a regional commander can declare martial law if he feels it warranted before even a presidential or gubernatorial declaration of martial law.
That's really interesting. And who could do that again, please?
The local field commander.
Field commander, a military field commander.
Yes, indeed.
Wow.
In fact, on my book, on pages 133 and 134, I reproduced the exact wording of federal law that allows a regional military commander on his own initiative to declare martial law.
That's a really justified wow. I didn't know that, Harry. It's hard to imagine any provision under any conditions that would allow that sort of decision to be made by a military person. That's incredible.
It is actually under, as I say in my book, the Code of Federal Regulations, Title 32, Subtitle A, Chapter 5, Subchapter A, Part 501.4. And I reproduced the full text of it. It surprised me when I found it, but it is on the books, and it is standing federal law.
Okay, first-time caller line. You're on the air with Harry Helms. Hello.
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 How you doing, Art?
Well, I was better earlier.
Yeah, I'm still up and at it.
I mean, when you hear some of this stuff, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, let me talk to Harry.
Yeah.
You are.
Here you are, okay. Yeah, my name's Michael from Indio, California.
Yeah.
And I have a comment, and this is relating to the subject. The United States government abides by international law that you cannot take away somebody's civil rights because of their race, ethnicity, religion, sexual orientation, whatever they'll be. That is, you know, politically sensitive. But if the U.S. government wants to, you know, propagate some movement to make citizens afraid of somebody's ancestry, racial origin, or religion, whatever you mention, somebody who voted for the wrong candidate, that the U.S. government had to tell the media, for you know, the newspapers or the radio or the movies or TV, I'm talking about to promote a hysteria atmosphere that'll make American citizens who mostly don't care or don't fear anybody because of such things.
You're talking about promoting a crisis, right? Manufacturing a crisis.
Yeah, something. This is exactly what the Nazis did in 1930s in Germany against Jewish people, trying to make up falsehoods that a group of people did this or that.
Or to forward a group that you now can officially hate and that it's officially sanctioned to hate. Yeah, that kind of thing, or the manufacture of any, I don't know, it could be ethnic, it could be otherwise, kind of crisis. You can imagine that scenario unfolding, Harry?
Yes, indeed. I would say to the caller, I would not place a great deal of reliance upon the United States government being deterred in taking certain actions by the fact that those actions would be in violation of international law. I don't think I would rely upon that for any degree of security or restraint upon U.S. government activities.
In the end, Harry, the only real protection we have against any of what you're talking about would be the people themselves in the end, right? I mean, that would be it.
Absolutely. And I think what we need is really a national debate on how do we respond to these crises effectively while at the same time preserving our constitutional rights in our civilian form of government.
Well, our ability to keep our freedom depends on our awareness, doesn't it?
It does, and also I think emergency plans or things of this nature, if, for example, we were to clearly spell out, here are the circumstances under which it may well be necessary to deploy federal troops for civilian law enforcement. I think we all recognize there could be certain situations, such as the aftermath of a major natural disaster or a terrorist event, when civilian law enforcement would break down or be overloaded, and it would be necessary to federalize it and militarize it to some extent.
Yes, people can imagine these scenarios, but what about the possibility of one of these scenarios being cooked up?
And that's the catch, and that's why we need to be very explicit, perhaps through constitutional amendments, on the circumstances when and where this can and should be done. The way it is right now, the latitude for deciding what constitutes a federal emergency and what measures may be taken are concentrated basically in the president. And there are very, for the first 6 months at least, Congress can basically do nothing but watch helplessly if the president decides to take some of these actions.
That would be for 6 months.
Yes. After that, the Congress can vote to rescind a presidential declaration of national emergency. But for 6 months, the president has pretty much free rein.
Well, if a president, let's just do a what-if scenario, Harry. If a president were evil, I'm going to use the E word. If a president were suddenly an evil president and he decided that he was going to take over, he was going to become a dictator, either kill or suppress all those who opposed him and take over the United States as its dictator, would 6 months of that power be long enough to ensure that be done?
It all depends on what matter he might want to try to, what measures he may wish to take.
I just told you, extreme ones, if necessary.
Such as arresting all members of Congress so they can't vote.
Yes. Yes, I mean, whatever. We're just speculating out on the edge of forever here. The president decided he wanted to take over as dictator, had, I don't know, Congress disbanded or shot or, you know, something awful. If a president just went berserk, does he have enough power without any checks in place for 6 months to get the job done?
Quite conceivably. One of the points I make in my book is Lincoln's actions during the Civil War. Lincoln did such things as shut down newspapers that in the North that opposed the war in the South. He did such things as order the spending of money absent a congressional authorization, which explicitly violated the Constitution.
Yeah.
He had even one United States congressman from Ohio who opposed the Civil War arrested just for the basis of making a public speech opposing the war. Now, that was Lincoln. Since then, the emergency powers available to the president
has
increased
expanded
greatly. So the president has far more tools and powers to choose from than Lincoln did.
How we depend on the goodwill of others. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Harry Helms. Hello.
Hello, Art. Hello, Harry.
Hello.
Listen, from what I understand, as more United Nations occupation troops enter the United States, the White House is and the two former administrations, they expect strong resistance from loyal Americans, from what I understand, and to quietly suppress these patriotic fighters. The last administration, President Clinton, was getting help from the old Soviet KGB, and they supplied the Clinton administration with a whole new class of weapons that was specifically targeted against American civilians.
And now, Harry, I hadn't heard that. Harry, have you?
That's news to me.
And I would want to ask you about this, Harry, specifically about these Soviet psychotronic weapons or mind control technology, and what would be the likelihood of the government using those type of dangerous weapons against our own people?
All right, well, that one we'll take a big bite out of. We did talk last night about the ability, for example, of HAARP to control human emotion, feeling, fear, produce, you know, a different state, even a confused state in a human being. Would you imagine a scenario, Harry, under which a government would use such a device, or even just a political party or a member of a political party would use such a device against its own citizens?
I would just say as a general rule that any government entity would be interested in as many non-lethal methods of population control as they could muster.
Persuasion.
There's been a very long and well-documented history of interest by various agencies in the United States government in mind control methods. The first use of LSD in the United States in the 50s was in experiments conducted by the Central Intelligence Agency.
It is, of course, true. It's true. And these astounding things that you go, holy mackerel, or worse, and then sort of let drift out of your mind because they're so outrageous. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Harry Helms. Hello.
Good morning. How are you doing today?
All right, sir.
Oh, thank you. This is Robert. I'm calling from Richmond, Virginia.
Hey.
I have a couple questions here real quick for Harry.
Yeah.
I've done a research paper in an English class, and I happened to do it on the Rex 84 program. And upon my research, I came across a couple of things that I thought were kind of odd and weird. So I was going to ask you to see what the legitimacy of these are.
Okay.
The first thing I came up with was rail cars with sprinkler systems in them. Have you heard anything about that?
I've heard rumors about that, which were supposedly to be used for dispensing of biological or chemical agents, but I've had no success in verifying that's anything more than a rumor.
Okay. The other thing is as far as crematories, I heard that, I heard the government was purchasing, old railroad stations, if I remember correctly, and installing crematories in them. Have you heard anything about that?
I have heard that rumor, but again, I haven't been able to find anything to support this, anything more than just an unsubstantiated rumor.
Okay. Boy, there's a couple I had not heard. Okay.
The final thing I want to ask is the Rex 84 program took place in the early 80s, and so that should be done and over with. You would think that the Denver Airport, which is also known as the New World Airport, which we're not talking about the New World Order tonight, but I also found information as far as them putting a concentration camp. Oh, did I say concentration camp? I meant to say a detainment camp underneath the airport. Have you heard any?
Well, the Denver Airport is really the source of a lot of hot rumors, whether they be of this sort or even the paranormal sort. I'm telling you, there's something about the Denver Airport. And I've been all over it, Harry, even down where they send the bags through the big machines. I've been all over the Denver Airport.
Having connected it through a couple of flights through Denver's airport, I can understand why you might think it is a detention center at times. But,
Well, yeah, but only until your flight.
Yes. But if it were a detention center, I think they would get their bags to your bags to you on time if it were a real detention center.
Yeah, or they'd do better with the bags.
Yes.
West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Harry Helms. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi, Mr. Bell. Hi, Mr. Helms.
Yes.
I got two questions. My first question is pretty long. I remember when I was a little kid, I remember seeing something called the Civil Defense. And are they still around? And
Civil Defense has been folded into FEMA.
Oh, I see. And my second question is it pretty expensive to get started as a ham radio operator? And approximately how much minimum would you need to get started?
Ah, somebody breaks us away from the government for a moment. And that's a really good question. All right. Get started as a ham, Harry.
If you're going with, say, the technician-level license, which is the entry-level license, 25 questions, no Morse code test. And it allows you operation on the 50 megahertz and higher bands and hopefully some lower-level bands once they modify the ham, the Morse code test requirements. You can get on the air with a small walkie-talkie unit for 2 meters or so for between $100 and $200. And for some of the other bands, antennas and such, even with new equipment, between $200 to $300. And if you're a judicious shopper of the used equipment market, probably for about half that amount.
So not that much to start into ham radio, right?
Very cheap for what you get.
Oh, boy, is it ever for what you get. Ham radio is one fun hobby, and I'd like to encourage as many of you as I can toward it. My guest is Harry Helms. We're talking, yes, about the shadow government, but also about radio and any other topic you'd like to bring up, because you're the ones in the spotlight now on the phones.
From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Indeed. You know, even doing a talk show like this, considering it, you got to gulp a couple times real hard before you do it. But I figured, what the hell? I mean, anything you can imagine. Look at science fiction, for example. Some of the wildest, craziest scenarios that are so hard to imagine could ever come true. Well, suddenly, they come true. And this is one of those things that if you close your eyes and imagine a military presence and a takeover and a government gone and freedoms evaporated, it seems impossible. You know, it just seems impossible. But on the other hand... Being absolutely honest, I've got to tell you that I always thought the kind of secret government that we've flirted with talking about from time to time with respect to other things like aliens and the knowledge of aliens and all the rest of that, that kind of government, that kind of behind the scenes, pulling the strings of the current government, I never was able to really grasp that as a concept I considered reasonable. Or that I thought it was really going on. Unfortunately, this kind of shadow government, the one described by Harry tonight, can be envisioned. And one can even close one's eyes and imagine how it would be implemented. And all it might take would be the will of the right person to make it all happen. Because everything, according to you, Harry, everything, and I think you're pretty much in line, is in place to do it if someone wanted to.
Yes, indeed. In fact, I found a quote here in my book from Senator Charles Mathias of Maryland, who was a Republican.
Yes.
Back in 1975, revealing some of the executive orders issued by the Nixon administration, their potential for misuse. And this is a direct quote from Senator Mathias. Under the authority delegated by these statutes, the president may seize property, organize and control the means of production, seize commodities, assign military forces abroad, institute martial law, seize and control all transportation and communication, regulate operation of private enterprise, restrict travel, and in a plethora of ways control the lives of all American citizens. And that pretty neatly sums up the situation as it exists today, except that the powers available to the president, should he decide to exercise them, are even greater than they were in 1975.
You know, Harry, a lot of people are going to want to get in touch with you, and so to prevent a gigantic amount of email from going across my computer, why don't you give out your email address?
Okay, Art, I'll let my server take the hit.
Yeah, there you go.
The website they can reach me at is www.the-shadow-government.com. And these dashes are hyphens between the words the-shadow-government.com.
All right. Well, that's a web address. How about your email address?
You can reach me at harry@the-shadow-government.com.
Harry, that's easy, H-A-R-R-Y, at the-shadow-government.com.
That's right.
Oh, cool. I'm thinking you're going to get a lot of email.
Yes.
Okay. You're on the air with Harry Helms. Good morning. Hello? 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 Going once. Going twice.
Hello?
Oh, finally we get a hello. Yes?
Hello? International Line?
Yes.
Hey, Art, great show.
Thank you.
Glad to make it in. I'm a long-time listener, first-time caller.
And where are you?
I'm down in Austin, KLBJ AM.
Okay.
I'm just curious, something that's... I've been researching the governmental realms and what's going on here for some time now.
You're going to have to speak up good and loud. You're not
about 10 years.
Yes.
And one of the concerns I have is a lot of these rumors about Chinese troops on the Mexican border, Russian troops.
Oh, yes.
Latvian troops up on the Canadian border.
Yes.
And this entire takeover of the United States. And I'm just curious as to, you know, from my perspective, it makes sense that in order to bring in a one-world government, you cannot have a superpower. You're going to have to bring everybody down into a an even keel, so to speak. And I wanted to find out, one, if there's any information that Harry, if you may know, that it is true that there are troops on these borders that are ready to come in and...
All right, I tell you what, it's a very good question you're asking. I've got a story in my hand. I don't know where this came from, but it says, big trouble in Mexico. Residents of New Mexico, it says, just north of the border with Mexico, report that Chinese troops are operating out of northern Mexico and frequently make incursions into the United States. The U.S. Border Patrol agents, who've spoken on condition of anonymity, meaning no sources here, right, fearing they will lose their jobs, said they've seen Chinese troops on the northern side of the border and that they have duly reported the situation to headquarters. Agents said large numbers of the troops are frequently on U.S. territory about 32 miles southwest of Las Cruces, New Mexico, near the town of Deming. Now, I have no idea if this is true, but this is circulating big time on the internet. Harry, I'm sure you've heard the rumors like the man was talking about. What do you have to say?
I've heard the rumors likewise, but I've seen nothing reliable or substantive to back them up. However, there is increased military activity along the borders on both sides, and there have been incursions of Mexican troops that have been very well documented. So
yes, but
clearly this is a situation that bears watching.
Yes, but surely if Chinese troops were on our border, I mean, that one would be grabbed up by the nightly news like you know what. Just pew, like
yes,
that.
And that's why I said there's been nothing substantive to back up those rumors.
But I'll tell you, the rumors are all over the internet. It's everywhere. Why do you suppose... these, assuming it's not true, we don't know for sure, but assuming that it's not true, how do you think these kinds of rumors are generated? Are they generated by the extreme right wing out there, Harry, who are sort of stoking paranoia?
There's two schools of thought. One is that you have China has replaced the Soviet Union as the most likely potential
enemy.
Adversary
yes,
for the United
yes.
States in a military sense.
Right.
The other rumor I have often, idea I've often entertained is that perhaps these rumors could be generated by the government itself in order to discredit or to serve as a cover story for some of the things they might be doing along the border.
All right. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Harry Helms. Hi.
Good evening. My name is John, and I live in the foothills of eastern Tennessee.
Hey, John.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to say I've been stopped twice by military roadblocks here in eastern Tennessee. On both occasions, I was forcibly removed from my car.
Military roadblocks?
Military roadblocks.
For what?
No apparent reason other than forcibly remove me from my car, to forcibly search my car, and I asked for explanations, got no answers from anybody.
Were you on a military facility?
No, I was. These were public highways. These
so you're telling me that the military has public highways cordoned off, and they're stopping people and yanking them out of cars and searching the cars?
So help me God, it's my witness.
Oh,
I've got better things to do with my time than to sit here and cook up a story. This is an actual honest-to-God fact, and these have been documented in eastern Tennessee newspapers.
Okay. Harry, have you heard about this?
I'm curious if your listener lives on a road in or near Oak Ridge or some other military facility.
No. These were nowhere near any military installation.
What kind of road was it? Caller, what kind of road was it? Was it like a local little street, highway?
These are both county highways.
County
both
highways. Okay.
Both travel county highways.
That's quite new. I have not heard about this happening inland in the United States, although my book does document several cases where the military have conducted roadblocks and searches on roads adjacent to the U.S.-Mexican border, but this is the first I've heard of it in an inland case.
They were printed up in the Knoxville, Tennessee Journal, or Knoxville, Tennessee Sentinel newspaper.
Okay, yeah. Caller, I've got a question for you. You were the one pulled over and searched. Did you have any sense of what they were hunting for?
Absolutely no idea. Absolutely no idea, none. I mean, I thought it was, I thought somebody was making a Hollywood movie. Everybody
were you
did.
Were you hurt?
Yes, because I have muscular dystrophy, and I was forcibly dragged out of my vehicle and thrown onto the ground, and he had a soldier kneel on top of me.
Yikes. So, all right, well, I don't know what to say about
that. I want to tell you
that.
One other thing. Art, I also wrote a letter to Father Malachy Martin about 15 years ago and asked him why I could find no references to the United States and biblical prophecy, and I proffered such a situation mentioning...
I think there is, in fact, a deficit of any mention in the Bible with... People have tried to find America, and they never have been able to, but that's straying way down a whole different path. The one, what he gave us there, this military roadblock... That's something else. You haven't even heard the rumors, huh, Harry?
That's new. I mean, there have been several incidents along the border, and then,
yeah, but that would be actually the border to a certain degree is federal territory, actually, right?
But here would be things like along the border, not at the border, roads within a few miles of the border, which there have been military roadblocks, searches of cars, and in a couple of cases, the actual shooting of civilians.
But short of the shooting, Harry, wouldn't you be in favor of this kind of thing?
If you're talking about American citizens on public roads,
I'm talking about troops at the border.
Troops at the border are one thing. When they start taking over civilian law enforcement facilities, my first question is, why them and not civilian law enforcement authorities?
Well, yes, but I'm backing up to what you said about having to tighten up the borders. I mean, how would you do it? You can't do it with ice cream. It's going to be with troops with guns, right?
Yes, but at the border, not several miles inside the border. In some cases, these have been like 30, 50 miles away from the border.
That's quite a way.
Yes.
All right. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Harry Helms. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, hello.
Yes, this is Raymond in Morgantown.
Yes, Raymond.
Back in the 60s, the Johnson administration had a special group on counterinsurgency headed by a Colonel William Corson, and he was commissioned to investigate American Indian movement and the Black Panthers and so forth, and any possible linkage between them and the student protests against Vietnam. And he concluded that without the students, the extremists cannot mount their revolution, and with them, they may be able to. Have you heard anything about that?
Yes, that was one of the conclusions that led to creation of Operation Garden Plot, the operational plan for involvement of the U.S. military in civilian disturbances. And in fact, they were monitoring the 1970 student anti-war protests, the ones that culminated in the shooting at Kent State, very carefully.
All right. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Harry Helms. Hello.
Hello, Mr. Bell. This is Brian in Bakersfield, KMZR country.
Hi, Brian.
Hi. It's a pleasure to be on your show again, particularly when you're... hosting this evening.
Happy to have you.
Thank you very much. And to Harry, as you probably know, Thomas Aquinas held that medieval philosopher held that monarchy was the most preferable and the best form of government, and in that I believe he was following Aristotle. So the tradition of monarchical government.
Your telephone's going away on us, sir, caller.
Well, I'm sorry about that. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I hear you.
I see you. Anyhow, both Aristotle and Thomas Aquinas in different eras held that monarchy was the most preferable form of government. And I'm quite sure that the president and our American government are quite aware of this tradition. Could it be that this plan, the contingency of martial law and the rest, may be a sort of reversion, albeit a contingent reversion, to monarchy as a last resort, as it is quite necessary when the final analysis, in the final analysis, to have a lone body, usually in the person of one ruler, but often in the case of, often extrapolated to a body, rather than having a various separate bodies to whom government is...
All right, so in other words, are we could this sort of thing precede the institution of monarchy, is what you're asking, right?
Yes.
Okay, Harry?
I don't know if the institution of monarchy is what it could lead to, but certainly the impact could be to the institution of a dictatorship or de facto strongman form of government. But you quoted Sir Thomas Aquinas. Well, I prefer to quote Benjamin Franklin, who said that those who would sacrifice their liberty for security deserve neither. And I think that's the key point here.
Indeed so, and I bet the, a key point probably in your book, isn't it?
Yes, indeed.
And again, I want to be able to promote your book for you a little bit, because obviously we've gone down some pretty... rickety, crooked, hard roads to navigate this morning, and a lot of people are going to want to read more, and you've written extensively on this subject, Inside the Secret Government. That's the title of your book. They can get it.
It's Inside the Shadow Government.
Inside the Shadow Government, thank you.
Yes, and it's available from bookstores or from Amazon or from our website at www.the-shadow-government.com.
Uh-huh. And when somebody reads this book cover to cover, are they going to come away informed, frightened, ready to become an activist, a believer? What do you think this book does to people who are, you know, sort of neophytes at this?
Hopefully they will come away all of those things, somewhat frightened, somewhat determined to make sure that some of these dire scenarios I discussed do not come to pass, and also to get more involved in their government and become less of a spectator and more of an active participant in the governmental process.
There are many people, Harry, who feel that they can't have an effect, that our government has gone to the point where anything they do at all, including, I should say, voting, simply is of naught, just doesn't change anything, doesn't... that there's not a dime's worth of difference between the parties, and it doesn't really matter who's president, and they just can't affect anything. There's a lot of that psychology in the country.
But such defeatism becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Look at it this way. What is the downside of participating? Can the situation get any worse if you do participate, if you do try to affect these changes? The answer is no. It can only get better. So then logically, this active participation and greater involvement by citizenry, it's worth the effort. It's certainly worth the risk.
Well, depending on whether you value your freedom or your safety, perhaps.
Well, I wrote the book, and hopefully other people, through the anonymity of a ballot box, can bring about some of these changes.
Well, way to go, Harry. It has been a total pleasure having you on the air with me again, and we went down a totally different road this night.
I've greatly enjoyed it, Art.
Well, thank you, and I hope you felt like you got to say everything you wanted to say about this.
I think I did, and I appreciate all of the callers, too.
Way to go, buddy. Good night.
Good night.
It's almost 2 a.m. somewhere. Huh? You know what? I'll be back tomorrow night. George is taking an additional night off, take care of a little bit of business, and so that's what I'll do, is take care of a little bit of business with you. So tomorrow night, Dr. Michio Kaku will be here, and that'll be another road from the high desert. Good night.